You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. It is a great pleasure for me this morning to welcome you to today's event, Reopening of the World, How to Save Lives and Livelihoods. Before we begin, I want to reiterate what I mentioned at our inaugural reopening-themed event a few weeks ago, that these are anything but ordinary times. Around the world, over 450,000 precious lives have been lost to this disease, COVID-19. In the United States alone, we'll pass 119,000 deaths today. A truly staggering loss of life in only a few short months. And while there are some early signs, hopeful signs, concerning an effective treatment for this disease, cases continue to spike all over the world. And now again in the United States, as some of the reopening strategies that we've talked about are failing. Around the world, government responses have been highly varied, some quite successful, but some catastrophic failures. And the global economy is in deep distress. Only widespread availability of a working vaccine will likely create stability needed for true societal recovery. And that, per the world's health experts, is likely some months away. It can be considered a bleak moment. And much of the world's population has been impacted in one form or another. But indeed, COVID-19 has proven in stark terms that we live, like it or not, in a global, interconnected community. This has unquestionably been so all along. It is even more so now. Sadly, the opportunities for global leadership to fight this pandemic, in some respects, have been squandered. And the requisite international cooperation has not emerged in any of the ways that we would have hoped. But there's still potential. Global collective solutions will thus be needed to put an end to this crisis. And while this moment may feel disheartening, I remain encouraged that through the work of institutions like Brookings and the heroic efforts of our health community and local leaders and many of the leaders around the world whose example we can emulate, we can still come out of this, and we can be stronger than before. Today's reopening of America and the World event, and with emphasis today on the world, represents Brookings' most important contribution to this moment thus far. But in the coming months, we'll also be contributing a substantial effort looking at the blueprint for long-term recovery, reform, and renewal of societies. These issues are central to saving as many lives and livelihoods as possible. And we hope to we will find you attending these events and that you'll find these events useful for your own purposes and for your communities to help to reopen and to recover in this moment of challenge. With that, a brief reminder that we're recording the event today and we're streaming it live. And if you'd like to ask any questions throughout the event, please send them to us by using the hashtag COVID reopening on Twitter. Let me now turn the floor over to my dear friend and colleague, Michael Hanlon, who's a senior fellow and the director of research in the foreign policy program, who will serve as today's moderator and member of the panel. But let me also close with the hope that all of you on this call today, that you and your families are well and that you're safe and that you will remain so. So Mike, over to you, please.
John, thank you, and very well said, and we certainly all join in that wish for everyone's well-being. I have a distinct privilege today of introducing a remarkable panel, and what we're going to do is look at a number of countries around the world, a number of key countries in this crisis, to see and take temperature, take stock of how things are going in each of these places, and that'll sort of be our opening round of discussion. And then after that, we'll have a second round where we try to figure out which best practices need to be more widely adopted, and then how countries can collaborate more effectively, as John hinted at, with or without strong leadership, but also asking the question of where that leadership can and should come from, and how multilateral efforts that go beyond individual countries doing their best can help with the next phase of recovery and reopening. So we'll begin with David Dollar in our foreign policy program, my good friend who spent a number of years in Beijing. He remains one of the world's top experts on the Chinese economy, but he also has the firsthand experience of sort of knowing how the Chinese deal with this kind of ailment or crisis in health, because he lived through a couple there, I believe, himself, and certainly has a good sense of Chinese society from his many years in Beijing. And he's now in the foreign policy program, as I say, working on the Chinese economy, but also doing his Dollar and Cents podcast that's become a big hit around much of the country and the world. After David, we'll go to Suzanne Maloney, who, in addition to being my other boss, along with John Allen, because she runs the foreign policy program at Brookings, is one of the world's top experts on Iran. And John Allen mentioned how some countries are doing better than others. Certainly Iran, I think it's safe to say, is a country not doing so well in handling the COVID crisis. But I'll let Suzanne inform us all a little bit about how the Islamic Republic is doing several months into this crisis at this juncture. At that point, we're then going to sort of pivot to Europe. And we have two experts who will be speaking about different dimensions of the European response to COVID, as well as the efforts, again, at reopening and recovery. Tony Pippa is in our Global Economy and Development Program. And he was a U.S. Special Envoy to the United Nations for negotiating the Sustainable Development Goals some years ago, in which the world tried to think about how to improve health and well-being, as well as other basic quality of life standards for humans around the globe. So he's been thinking about these sorts of questions a long time. He's now at Brookings, as I say, and has specialized most recently in a paper and research on a number of European cities and how they have been handling COVID. And he also has some experience, as I say, with the Sustainable Development Goals and therefore a broader global perspective. And I think he first attained his world professional tennis ranking in Harare, which means he's got some experience on the Africa dimension of things as well. Then we will go to Celia Bélin, who's our visiting French scholar and just a wonderful member of the foreign policy team, who really gets her own country and our country and their relationship and a lot of Europe extremely well. She's one of the most insightful voices, wrote a great book this winter on the Democratic Party primary process and the big ideas that were being debated in Iowa and New Hampshire, where she spent a lot of time on the ground. But more commonly, more frequently, she's an expert on Europe and her own country. And she will certainly talk about how France is doing with its initial stages of reopening, which in some ways, I believe, are going better than many might have expected, given the prevalence of COVID in France and the danger we all know that this crisis could again worsen and there could be a second wave even in countries that seem to have made major progress. But we'll finish with Jung Pak, who, in addition to having written and just published one of my favorite Brookings books of all time called Becoming Kim Jong-un, and who, in addition to being one of the world's great experts on North Korea, a country she used to study at the CIA before joining Brookings 3 years ago, has written a good deal about COVID and the response in both South Korea as well as North Korea. And certainly the Republic of Korea, South Korea's response has been one of the most important and successful, probably top three or four most successful approaches to handling COVID. Although certainly the problem is not over yet, and we've seen resurgences in Korea as well as in Beijing in recent times. So with that as an introduction, we're going to begin with David and then move to Suzanne, Tony, Celia, and Jung. And so really I have the same question to open up for everyone, which is, how are things going in the country that you know best, that you study most in your field of research? How are we doing? How is the world doing in handling COVID as well as the recovery and reopening process? So David, over to you, my friend.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. In China, reopening the economy is going surprisingly well given how serious the epidemic was there. China really locked down the whole economy, particularly during the month of February. Looks like real economic activity declined by about 20% compared to the year before, and we never see changes like this, so it was quite breathtaking. But they seem to get the virus under control relatively quickly, And so the economy's been climbing back over the last couple months. And here in June, it looks like the economy's actually ahead of where it was a year ago. So they've turned to slightly positive growth, which is pretty remarkable. But as Mike mentioned, there's a new outbreak in Beijing, more than 100 cases. It seems to be a strain that came from Europe. And it's just a reminder that no one has eliminated this virus. So getting it under control means continuing to need to test. In the case of this Beijing resurgence, they moved quickly to close public schools, lock down the relevant neighborhood. Everyone in China is wearing masks and practicing social distancing. I have a lot of friends in offices there, and they're staggering work, so there are never too many people in the office at the same time. So I think the first lesson from China is that reopening the economy has to go hand in hand with controlling the virus. And until there's a reliable vaccine, that means constant vigilance and social distancing. If I could just briefly add a second point, Mike, I would say that while China's economy on average seems to have gotten back to normal, it's tremendously uneven across sectors. It seems people are not comfortable just returning to their old lives. For example, traffic congestion is back to normal, which is kind of unfortunate because normal traffic in China is pretty terrible. But subway ridership is down 20%. Auto sales are actually up. So people are going out, buying cars, driving more, but they're not taking intercity transportation on air or rail. They're not going to the movies. They've cut way back on different types of entertainment. So what you see is booms in certain sectors. Construction, for example, is booming. Apartment sales are back to normal. Healthcare, of course, has expanded dramatically. On the other hand, there are important sectors of the economy that are really hurting. So I think the second lesson from recovery is that it's going to be a long, painful process. There will be many workers and firms that are essentially in the demand is dried up, and they're going to need to either wait that out, or it may turn out these changes in behavior are permanent. And so you're going to need public policy to help these workers and firms and to smooth the adjustment. So that's my quick assessment of where things are in Beijing. Thank you, Mike.
Fantastic, David. Thank you for starting us so well. And Suzanne, now over to you on Iran.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to all of you. I'm really glad to be here for this discussion. The Iranian case, I think, is a cautionary tale. The Iranians struggled from the outset to manage the virus. There was an attempt to obfuscate at the initial phases, even as health officials were appealing publicly in late January to halt air traffic to China. The government effectively refused to acknowledge that the virus had hit Iran until mid to late February, announcing the first case on the day that they announced the first death. This was a variety of factors, desire to make sure that people turned out for parliamentary elections in mid-February, as well as, I think, a refusal to fully appreciate how significant the pandemic would hit. Iran was, of course, the first case of a country where we saw how devastating this virus could be, with viral photos of mass graves circulating as early as February, and much of the senior leadership directly impacted, including a number of deaths. The Iranians then moved in late February to try to get a handle on the crisis by instituting some measures of lockdowns, closing schools and many businesses. But largely there was a disinclination to impose frankly, a lack of capacity to impose the level of severe lockdown that we saw in China. Of course, Iran has been hard hit by sanctions imposed by the United States since Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in May of 2018. And the calculation on the part of the Iranian leadership was that they could not afford to impose the severe measures that we saw in China and elsewhere in East Asia. There was another calculation as well. The Iranian leadership, in many cases, based on their rhetoric and I think consistent with their worldview, saw the virus as something of the latest conspiracy on the part of the West, effectively designed to try to completely eradicate Iran's economic capability and as a result to bring down the regime. And so there was a kind of determination to maintain some level of normalcy simply to demonstrate that they would not be bowed, that they could not be crushed by a pandemic nor by American sanctions. And so what they did was effectively take advantage of a national holiday, the Nowruz holiday, which falls in mid-March, when the country typically does close. And they simply extended some of the closures that would typically happen anyway, but then began to bring the country back to full business as usual as early as early April. And so what we've seen as a result of that is that cases have spiked as recently as last week, with the largest number of cases since the pandemic hit in Iran. The death rate is back up to where it was in February and March before the closures. And I think one of the takeaways from this entire experience on the Iranian side is simply how difficult any kind of measures like this are to impose unless you have full consensus on the part of the leadership and the capacity to absorb a significant economic hit. Reports from Iran these days suggest that Iranians are just tired of the measures, that they have largely abandoned social distancing, that the mask wearing is not being enforced in most public places. And I think what we're likely to see is what President Rouhani says, is that this is simply a case where everyone must be ready for life with coronavirus. Iran is settled in for a long haul with this crisis, and we're likely to see the death toll and the economic toll, as well as the political implications, be quite significant and long lasting.
Thank you. And a quick follow-up before I go to Tony. I'll probably have a similar follow-up with Jung Pak later because of the strategic significance of Iran above and beyond the health issues. And so I wondered if you could just give a quick sense as to whether you sense any kind of instability or threat to the regime from internal dissent and the frustration of the Iranian population. My guess is the answer is no, because that regime historically has done a pretty good job of of essentially sitting on top of its own people and making sure that it makes the decisions and carries out the policies it wants. On the other hand, there is some element of democratic process in Iran, and there have been changes in at least the presidency as a reflection of internal and domestic conditions and preferences. Do you see COVID in any way changing sort of the geopolitics of Iran?
The short answer would be no, that in fact the pandemic has essentially enabled the government to reimpose a severe control over its own population in a way that was already being contested as early as recently as last fall, when there were significant violent protests in Iran as a result of economic austerity. But I think that also forebodes trouble in the long term for Iran, that the hit to the economy is one that the population is simply quite weary of, and there is deep frustration with the system, there is deep frustration with the economic predicament and with this leadership. And to the extent that the crisis, which has closed borders, which has disrupted Iran's measures for buffering economic sanctions through regional trade, only exacerbates the economic predicament of the country, I don't think the long-term picture for the Iranian system is necessarily stronger today than it was before the pandemic.
Thanks very much. Tony, over to you to give a little bit of a comparative and regional take on, I think, Europe in general, but I'm sure you're going to hit on two or three particular cities and countries in particular and with specificity. So over to you, please.
Thanks, Mike, and it's great to be here today. Yeah, I want to take a step back and just even talk about cities in general. Let's realize that cities were really the hardest hit. They constitute the epicenters pretty much everywhere worldwide. You heard David talk about Beijing. So we've watched as they've been on the front lines of the response to this, and they're also going to be the front lines of reopening and recovery. COVID really strikes at the very heart of what it means to be a city, what makes them special, gives them their unique identity, cultural events, restaurants, sports, entertainment, and city leadership knows that they know that it constitutes a leadership challenge, actually, to reopen, to have people feel safe, but also enjoy and meet the demands of enjoying what it means to be in a city. European cities were some of the first to actually pass the peak. When we think of iconic images, we think of Milan, and Andrea Bocelli sort of in Duomo Plaza, sort of empty. That was one of the hardest hits areas of the world. Milan itself, you know, constituted almost up to a quarter of what the cases were in Italy, and had very high death rates as well, above 15, almost 18%. And as mayors and local officials are thinking about what it means to reopen, they're trying to do so in stages. They realize that that staging can be sensed as unfair, and so they're trying to manage the political dynamics of that. They also see that COVID has really exposed the implications of inequality and the vulnerabilities of particular neighborhoods and particular people. And not only that, but it's also deepened it. So as they seek to reopen, they're seeking ways in which to actually meet the vulnerabilities of those particular people. In Milan itself, for example, they created a mutual aid fund, private as well as public dollars, mixing it together, trying to reach those particular people, created a set of food hubs to be able to get out to people. And as they watch what's happening with reopening and try to stay ahead of a potential second wave, they're also thinking about what it means to create an economy that brings those people back into economic activity. And I think that's the second point I would make, is that their citizens are not willing to go back to the status quo. Their citizens have experienced what the implications of those inequalities are. To David's point, they also, Milan again, I'll stay with Milan, they experienced a significant improvement in air quality during the time of the outbreak. They had one of the worst air qualities in Europe, actually. And so they want to try to accelerate their progress on issues around climate change, around air pollution, at the same time as they're bringing and reshaping an economy that includes more people who are vulnerable prior to COVID. They're going to have to do all this under severe economic pressure. They don't have money. They both had to spend money on services, and they're losing revenue, obviously. And I think the third point I will make before throwing it back to you, Mike, is what a point that John Allen made around global cooperation. But this COVID crisis really shows how the global is local. And I think in one of the bright spots of global cooperation, you do have mayors using pre-existing networks to reach out to each other. Just a couple of weeks into the pandemic, Mayor Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles convened 45 mayors from across the world, share experiences, give tips. You know, the mayors of Seoul, the mayors of Milan provided some insights into what had happened in their city to help those prepare that were coming. And I think, and we're seeing actually almost an explosion of that at the amongst local leaders at the global level. And so we can talk a little bit about that later.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. And Celia, over to you to talk about France in particular, now that we've had a little broader framing about the European situation more generally.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. Yes, I'll talk a little bit about France, because France was among the countries that had one of the most severe lockdowns. You couldn't go out of your apartment or house unless you had a justification to do so. And after 8 weeks of lockdown and a death toll that is among the four top in Europe, which is almost 30,000 by now, France has started to reopen quite early, which is in May 11. But it reopened gradually and cautiously. There was a sense of urgency that the Prime Minister Edouard Philippe really pushed very strongly, because the economy was on the verge of collapse. You had one of the France was one that was most hit by the virus. Its GDP contracted by 5.8% in the first quarter of 2020. And the OECD prediction for France are amongst the worst, with Italy, Spain as well. The single hit scenario is minus 11.4% for GDP. So this is a terrible scenario. And if in the case of a double hit of a sort of a second wave, that would be even worse. So reopening was imperative, and the government pushed for it, even when the scientific councils and experts were mostly cautious and advising the government to be slow in the reopening. The French themselves were very apprehensive about reopening. They were among the Europeans that were most afraid of the virus. And then you had reactions of people that asked for a compulsory wearing of masks outside the home. So a sort of a strong reaction that was not expected. I think the government underestimated the fear of the people at the time of reopening, even though reopening was welcome as just a breath of fresh air. So the first steps of reopening were reopening of certain businesses, the freedom to leave without justification. But I think one of the most interesting choice from the Macron government was to reopen early the schools, contrary to what to many other European countries, contrary to what has been done, at least in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. There was, of course, it was a gradual reopening focused more first on daycare, then on primary schools and now middle school. And now they are expected to be fully reopened by June 2022. And the decision was highly controversial because the Scientific Council advised against it. And yet, a few weeks into the reopening of school, it has really shifted the mood in France, I must say. The fact of having people sending their kids back to school meant that more people were free to go back to work. And more generally, that life felt a little bit more normal. And so you have now people expecting summer vacation, which is an important element of French culture, with more hope than they've had in months. And people now are getting much more worried about the state of the economy than they are about the pandemic. And so far, this sort of gradual reopening has proved successful. You have infections that are still down with less than 500 new cases per day in the country, which leaves partly doctors and other experts a little bit wondering why is the reason for the fact that infections are not back up. Partly it's because of masks, but partly mask wearing that has generalized in France in a way that was never the case, but also because there's a threefold reopening strategy. One is to protect, so it's the mask and the social distancing. Second is testing, massive testing. And third is isolation. So every time you're tested positive as a COVID patient, but also as a contact, you will be asked to isolate and you will have support, economic support on part of the government, sick leave and other type of support for you to isolate, even if you're just a contact. So far, this has proven to work quite well. My last point will be on the political situation. Paradoxically, Macron and his government have been one of the most criticized, even though there was a sort of a rally around the flag effect. Macron's approval numbers are still down. The confidence in government handling of the crisis is still deteriorating. And there are several reasons for that. Part of it is that there was already difficulties, political difficulties for Emmanuel Macron. Part of it is a lack of transparency at the onset of the crisis over masks and testing, which has then translated in a lack of trust in the voice of the president. But the paradox of this is that the French society has been extremely united in the crisis. Actually, health directives have been fully obeyed, without any, virtually no protest over lockdowns, and that it was sort of a successful social experiment. And last point, the municipal election, the second round of the municipal election is coming up at the end of June. The first round happened just at the beginning of the crisis, the day before lockdown. So I think it will be an interesting moment to take stock of what's happening politically in France. And once again, with a government that has sort of been able to push its country through the crisis, but has lost a lot politically in the meantime.
Thank you. Fascinating. John Pak, thank you for joining us as well. And over to you, my friend, to talk about both Koreas a little bit, if you could. I think with more of an emphasis perhaps on South Korea, but whatever you would like to share in terms of how things are going in those two countries. Over to you, please.
Thanks, Mike. And I'm so happy to be joining my colleagues today to talk about this important topic. So let me talk about South Korea first. And it's that, as many people know, South Korea has been lauded for its incredible efforts in tackling the pandemic head on. Unlike France and other places, there was no lockdown. And unlike France as well, President Moon and his party had an electoral landslide in the legislative elections in April 15th as a result of the people's perception of the government's doing well on this issue, and also speaks to how that elevated President Moon. South Korea had innovative testing facilities, drive-through testing, telephone booth-style kiosks for testing and consultations, and a robust tracking and treatment facilities and government and private cooperation, as well as local and national cooperation. So the numbers, when South Korea decided to reopen, transition to everyday life quarantine on May 6th, the numbers were of new infections were in the single digits. It was 7.4 when the government decided to start easing these restrictions. So South Korea right now has a total of 12,000 cases, 10,000 have recovered, and fewer than 300 deaths overall. Which is really astonishing for me because, living in Maryland, we're still looking at hundreds of people being infected on a daily basis. But before they reopened, there was a public campaign, as there was the government's work in all of this was robust during the pandemic. But as they reopened, the government was also had a robust guidelines. So there was a public campaign to ensure public health precautions, including lots of signs and lots of advertisements about washing hands, social distancing, special measures for the elderly, communities putting forward designating a public health manager. And so there was some hope that this was going to, that life was going to return back to normal. But after reopening, a couple of weeks after reopening, there was a spike in cases. So it went from 7, and then after reopening, it went to about 45. Most of the spikes came from a robust social scene in the Itaewon district of South Korea, where there are lots of restaurants and clubs and karaoke bars and other bars. Given that spike, the government quickly responded by saying that free of charge, everyone can get tested. And so in tracking those people who were infected at those clubs in those districts, the government did 60,000 tests in 10 days and really made sure that they were able to identify, locate, and disinfect those facilities and really make people aware that the coronavirus is still around. So after that initial round of reopening, the government tightened guidelines, it shut down some public facilities, and it offered free anonymous testing. And one of the interesting things about this club venue was that there was a lashback against LGBTQ communities. And what the government did was to remove that stigma, there would be anonymous testing to make sure that people got tested regardless of whatever, without fear of reprisals. So for high-risk facilities, there's entry registration for nightclubs and gyms. They're requiring tracking and health monitoring phone apps for foreign visitors and who are supposed to quarantine. And there are things like mask vending machines in parks and in subways, which make it much easier for people to follow these guidelines. And just anecdotally, we've heard stories about how people without masks out on the street would get dirty looks from their fellow citizens. And so there is this collective kind of enforcing of, you know, making sure that people are following these guidelines. So that said, the government and the South Korean people are still very cautious. They're wary, they're monitoring, assessing, and they remain vigilant. Mr. Dae-jung Lee, who spoke at one of the East Asia, one of Brookings' panels last month or in the past few weeks, who formulated these guidelines in South Korea, he said, it's not over until it's over. And I think that's something that's a different attitude that South Korea has, is that it's not over, it's still around. Mr. Lee said, we still know very little about the virus, hence that vigilance that the government continues to have. I think and the government and, you know, the public health officials have said, you know, I think they're looking at muscle memory of best practices, that new procedures are now normalized in terms of temperature checks, entry registration, to say to the public that there is a need to go back and forth between easing and restricting. So it's not this linear path for reopening everything, but that there'll be some bumps and some obstacles. What we've seen here is that they're trying to reduce density or encouraging reduction of density, flexible work days, half days at school, no mask, no metro policies. And we still see this, the existing framework of testing, tracing, and treatment. Professor Sheen, who has written for the Reopening America Project at Brookings, said, you know, this is not new. The testing, tracing, treatment that South Korea learned this kind of infrastructure of how to tackle pandemics from our CDC, when South Korea was dealing with MERS in 2015. So let me stop there on South Korea. On North Korea, it's still a black box on what's going on in North Korea in terms of the coronavirus. The regime to this day says that there are zero infections. We're not even talking about deaths. We're talking about zero infections. And I think in a sense, the North Korean regime was built for this kind of pandemic response, and that they could order these lockdowns. They've closed the borders. They stopped these containers from being loaded so that the goods can be disinfected. That said, you know, even though, as the government says that the regime in Pyongyang says that there are zero infections, we would see reports trickling out of North Korea that 100 people here, 200 soldiers there, some villagers in a province have died from fever-related or symptoms that look consistent with COVID. So we still don't know, but from my perspective, I think it would be really hard to believe that there are zero infections, given the robust trading and smuggling networks along the 900-mile border with China. So let me stop there on the Koreas, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks, Jung. I'm gratified that, you know, from a military planning perspective, my area of specialty at Brookings, we have three of the big four countries that are top Pentagon concerns and threats represented on this panel, between Jung Pak, Suzanne Maloney, and David Dollar. And so in addition to talking about public health, we're talking about geopolitics here. I do have one quick follow-up, Jung, before we go to round two of sort of how we can learn best practices from each other and collaborate more effectively. And the follow-up would be, without getting into a lot of detail, at a time when North Korea apparently has decided to make its presence known again by doing things like blowing up buildings that previously were shared for dialogue with South Korea, I guess the way I would put my question to you is right now in South Korea, what's your sense about what people are more afraid of? Are they more afraid of COVID or more afraid of Kim Jong-un?
I think it's more of COVID versus Kim Jong-un. North Korea doing provocative things is not new. What makes it difficult is the unpredictability and the tactical ambiguity about all of this. But I would say that given the deep contractions in South Korea's economy as a result of coronavirus, that a lot of people are very much focused on the economy. The government, Seoul, is very much aware of this. They've had three rounds of economic stimulus packages. I would say, Mike, that, and this, I think this is generally true, and the pandemic exacerbates the situation, is that the economic anxieties and economic stresses are at the forefront of people's minds.
Thank you. So let's please have a round of conversation about lessons to be learned. And I'm going to invite every person to interpret that topic as they wish, whether it's lessons that the countries you study most have themselves already learned that should be more generally applied, whether it's lessons that your countries need to learn from others, or whether it's ways in which we can do a better job collaboratively and multilaterally working together, whether through WHO or renewed American leadership, or however you define the type of cooperation that we might better employ going forward. So David, I want to begin with you and go with the same order, but I guess the way I would couch the question specifically in regard to China is, which lessons can we really learn from China, given that China's system of government is so different and, autocracies may be able to do things that democracies can't. So in addition to knowing how China's been successful, I'd like to know which lessons really can be more widely adopted in countries like the United States and in Western Europe. Over to you, please.
Well, Mike, I found listening to the panel quite fascinating. And the thing that strikes me is that countries that have done relatively well are a mix of democracies and authoritarian states. I mean, mostly democracies. South Korea, we didn't talk about Taiwan. Celia was talking about how French people surprised her by following the rules. Germany's done well, Finland, New Zealand. In fact, the clearest correlation is that countries run by women have done well, and most of those tend to be democracies. It seems to me there is a common playbook here, and the virus started in China. So I think the elements of the playbook really came out of China. And it's true that it would be hard in the United States to have the kind of lockdown that China's had. Still, we've had cities in America have pretty tough policies about keeping, closing schools, forcing social distance, encouraging people to wear masks. So we're going to get a lot of variation across the United States. But it seems to me the basic playbook from all these successful cases is pretty clear. Jung Pak summed it up well, that it's not over till it's over. So we need constant vigilance in terms of testing, and then isolating cases, wearing masks, following social distancing. Communities that are doing this are getting it under control, both democratic and authoritarian communities. And communities that are not following that playbook are seeing a continuation or even a spiking of cases. If I could just very briefly weigh in, the third interpretation of your question, I actually think is the most important thing right now, which is that we've had very poor international cooperation so far. And there's so many different dimensions, but I would highlight, you've got lots of individual companies researching a vaccine for this. Probably someone will invent one. That's fine. I don't really care which company invents it, but you're going to need good cooperation, particularly between the United States and China, to manufacture this vaccine very quickly and make it distributed worldwide. Otherwise, I think that could become quite ugly if some country tries to monopolize or politicize that. There are other important international issues. We haven't said much about Africa, and I know we can't get too diverted, but the virus is spreading in many African countries, and you're going to need economic support and debt relief. And that's another area where if the U.S. and China do not cooperate, or more generally, if China and the West do not cooperate, then you're going to have devastating economic crises in the places where poverty is already high. So I think this is a moment where we need better international cooperation, and we're really not seeing it.
Thank you. And thank you for teeing up the Africa question as well. I know we have a few questions already from the audience that will return to that subject, and we'll look forward to getting to audience questions by about 10:30 for roughly the last half hour. So thanks for those points. Suzanne, I assume that you're going to tell us that Iran needs to learn more lessons than it really has lessons to offer others. But I'm also curious if you want to reflect on the broader Middle East region and any lessons you have there for regional cooperation or learning from each other. Over to you, please.
Thanks. Well, I think, you know, what the main takeaway for Iran is to riff on something that an Iranian government advisor tweeted actually early in the crisis, which is that the coronavirus is more fatal when there is an underlying condition, and that Iran came into this crisis with severe underlying conditions. Obviously, the economic devastation imposed by U.S. sanctions, which had cratered the economy, the value of the currency, oil exports down by at least 80%, and very difficult conditions for conducting ordinary financial transactions. So Iran came into this with huge deficits that compromised and really made its response that much less effective. In addition to the economic deficits, I think you also have to point to the deficits in terms of government capability. What we see from Iran is the lack of unity, the lack of transparency, the lack of trust in the government, the fact that you had officials from the health ministry openly feuding with officials from various economic ministries about what the appropriate response was, that the parliament has itself criticized the official statistics as at least an undercount by at least 50% of the official death toll. There were some places where I think Iran had greater capability to respond, and it's important to note that. There is a decent, even a strong underlying primary health system. Iran has, from its experience as a result of 40 years of economic sanctions, as well as the conflicts that it's been involved with, a considerable degree of capacity to mobilize industrial capability to meet a crisis. And so what we saw was, in the early days, there was a lack of masks, in part because the Iranians had shipped millions of masks to China as a goodwill gesture before they appreciated that the pandemic had spread. But today, Iran has managed to develop its capability across the whole spectrum of PPE and even treatments. There, many of them have been mocked in the Western press because of some of the rhetoric of Revolutionary Guard leaders and others. But I think it's notable that the Iranians have managed to really strengthen their ability to respond through medical treatment and PPE at a time when they were under severe sanctions that were even impacting the health system. The final point I just want to draw, though, is one that extends beyond the region, and that is that what we see from the experience in Iran is that all of the, you know, pre-existing conditions, all of the problems that existed before the pandemic really haven't gone away and have been magnified and exacerbated by this crisis. For the Middle East, the crisis also coincided with and exacerbated a broader economic crisis, which was the collapse of oil demand and then oil prices, contributed to by the Saudi-Russian price war that came really as this pandemic began to spread across the region. And so, you know, I think it's important to remember that what we've seen in terms of the pandemic in the Middle East hasn't obviated or hasn't made the other issues that existed before go away. The civil wars and the conflicts in Yemen and Syria, for example, the collapse of the Iranian nuclear deal and the slow but steady rebuilding of Iran's nuclear capabilities. And perhaps for the long term for the Middle East, most importantly, the much more complicated path that the region is going to have to meaningful economic reform, because the pandemic didn't just hit the local economies, it hit all of those non-oil sectors that are so important, travel, tourism, shipping, to capacity across the region. And so when you think about countries like Saudi Arabia now facing lower oil revenues and a long-term plateau in global demand for fossil fuels, their prospects for completely reforming and diversifying their economy are going to be that much more difficult today as a result of the COVID crisis.
Thank you, Suzanne. And Tony, over to you. I think this question probably should play very well to your research, given that you're always looking for cities learning from each other. You mentioned Mayor Garcetti earlier and the phone calls he's convened and trying to share best practices. What would you offer by way of maybe, even if a playbook is starting to emerge and we are starting to see some best practices that are common across many countries, maybe there are still some key lessons that you think need to be learned better? Or as David said, maybe the next round of this with thinking ahead to vaccine distribution and manufacture is what's on your mind the most. I'd be curious for how you would answer the question of sharing best practices.
So a couple of things I will say. One, just even in terms of a lesson that I think can really be drawn from the city experience and from the leadership experience of mayors and others. You know, local leadership actually tends to enjoy higher levels of trust amongst their constituents than state or national. And mayors have really leveraged that, but they do it through transparency and communication. They need to respond to their constituents in a very direct way. And so Mayor Marvin Reese in Bristol, the mayor, the leaders in Seoul, even Eric Garcetti in Los Angeles, they become known for constant communication and outreach, both to constituents as well as local leaders and other stakeholders, and using lots of interesting means, everything from WhatsApp chat groups to social media, to the technology that we're on now, just doing Zoom. But in terms of cooperation, I mean, one lesson that I hope we could start to really integrate is, you know, the multilateral system and the WHO and what we're depending on for global cooperation is led by countries, but it's really cities that are on the front lines. So integrating cities into the policy conversations, because they are going to be the ones that are going to have to make sure, for example, that vaccines get distributed to everyone and reach everyone. They are going to be the ones that have to create the systems of outreach and dissemination. And they're being very pragmatic with their own cooperation. When they were getting no guidance from the international community or even their own national governments, like I said, they reached out to each other. The meeting that I suggested that Eric Garcetti convened of 45 mayors from across the world was through a network called C40, which is a set of cities focused on climate change mitigation. But they repurposed that to say, we need to be in conversation. We need to be sharing these lessons back and forth. They're pragmatic. They're problem solving. They're looking for solutions. They're putting politics aside to be able to meet the needs that are coming forward. And you see that in lots of different guises. The mayors of Latin America convened by Buenos Aires, all the capitals getting together and communicating on a regular basis. And it's not just C40. I mean, it's the Urban 20, which is a group of large cities out of the G20 creating their own recovery task force. C40 has created a recovery task force chaired by the mayor of Milan. The difficulty is that it's a fragmented ecosystem. There are many different kinds of these systems. And they aren't necessarily plugged in directly into the policy conversations, and they have boundaries. They aren't going to be the ones that can affect vaccine development and lead that. You know, they quickly hit limits even in trying to coordinate procurement and not compete against each other for materials and PPE. So they really need the WHO, they really need the Vaccines Alliance, Gavi, they really need those particular institutions to be working well. But at the same time, I think they bring a model of leadership and can sort of potentially influence that to be more pragmatic and more solutions oriented. I'll just leave with one anecdote. You know, the day that President Trump pulled out the United States from the WHO, the deputy mayor of Los Angeles was on the line with a team from Jakarta, just sharing best practices and experience and tips for preparing them for what was going to happen in their city based on the experience they had. That's more of what we need within the international community. And I think mayors and cities can help us get there.
That's great. Thank you very much. Celia, over to you. Again, I know European states are constantly watching and learning from each other. There are a number of best practices emerging. Now we're into this new phase of reopening where France seems to be leading the way in many regards. Be curious for your thoughts on how best practices can be better shared at this juncture.
Well, first, there's more of a general lesson that the French society seems to have learned from this crisis. When they're asked what is the main lessons to be learned from coronavirus, actually, a big chunk of them would say you need to put more money in research, medical research in particular. But the big majority, 57%, said that the main lesson was that we have not sufficiently respected the natural world. And that's, I think, one of the biggest developments on the European side, is that the climate change priority has been even more prioritized after such a crisis. Tony was saying earlier that people in Milan were not accepting of air pollution anymore. You see exactly the same thing in France, where 3 French out of 10 demand more protection from air pollution. That's just one example of a sort of recognition of the unhealthy condition of life in many cities that are now unacceptable. But more generally, this idea that the pandemic comes from a disturbance of ecosystem. We have here at Brookings a fantastic scholar, Vanda Felba-Brown, who has written on the issue of wildlife trafficking and the disruption of ecosystem, and how these disruptions and the trafficking can be the seeds for the next pandemic, that might explain this pandemic, but could also provoke other pandemics. And so the conversation between the sort of unhealthy condition of pollution plus the challenge of biodiversity and ecosystem and the general threats of climate change has really risen the idea of climate action to a top priority in Europe. You see that with the European Green Deal that existed even before the pandemic, but that is another priority. Both President Macron and Chancellor Merkel have emphasized that the next challenges will be on climate action. And a lot of people in Brussels are now pushing for green finance to be at the heart of the recovery effort, so as to take the opportunity of this massive recovery effort and recovery funds that are going to be spent to be focused on a more green and sustainable path. The other, I would say that's sort of the main lesson, but there's another in the realm of foreign policy, another conversation that's going on, and you alluded to it, Michael, about the absolute need to have universal access to tests, to treatments, and to vaccines. And that can only be done through a collective cooperation in multilateral organizations. Because the idea is that it's not just a moral thing, but it's self-interest, because as long as the virus thrives somewhere, everybody will be insecure. There's only collective action that can really tackle the challenge. And I think that's why Europeans in general, French in particular, support the initiatives at the UN under WHO for a universal, to secure universal access to tests, treatments, and vaccines. And there was a donors conference organized by the EU Commission that raised $8 billion a month ago from 40 countries. And there, in this specific case, the US is missing. The US leaving WHO, but also for the increasing rivalry with China, seems to be dismissive of bigger multilateral initiatives like this, even though they're still working very much under on WHO reform as well. But in terms of leadership, the US is missing, and I guess hopefully that could be the lessons learned for the US, that it cannot just disregard a collective cooperation mechanism, and that hopefully it will join back in these types of initiatives.
Thank you. Jung Pak, earlier you said memorably, it ain't over till it's over. Anytime Jung Pak paraphrases Yogi Berra, I tend to take notice and listen carefully. So which other practices do you think of the various litany of successful efforts that South Korea has made, which do you think the world needs to maybe take more heed of? Because even if, as David Dollar said, we're starting to see the emergence of a common playbook, clearly South Korea's performance is so much better than most countries that it presumably still has some things to teach. And I think you probably touched on some of them earlier. So I wonder if you wanted to reiterate and reemphasize, and anything else you'd like to add on that question, please.
What's so striking about this conversation today, the title is Reopening After COVID, but we've talked about so many things other, you know, in addition to coronavirus, which is climate change, national security, diplomacy, instability, governance, and all of those things suggest that, you know, what this pandemic has shown us is that national security and that our national security priorities have to be rejiggered in a way that accounts for all of these challenges that pandemics and these transnational challenges that we face, whether it's climate change and pandemic, of course, and these are very much intertwined. And if anything, given some the politicization of the WHO and how the weaknesses of the multilateral organizations have been to politics and global politics, is that, you know, this really highlights the need for sustainable infrastructure and a rejiggering of our national security priorities, not just ours, but for other countries that we've been talking about. And South Korea does have a blueprint, and they've been freely sharing this with other countries, other mayors, Tony, and other officials, other health officials. And I think that's the important thing. One of the things that's notable about the way South Korea has dealt with this is that they put the experts up front. So the briefings daily came from the head of the Korean CDC, not a government official. There was an across-the-board inter-bureaucratic effort to put together this blueprint. So the economic and finance, public health, as well as the other government entities. So there's that. But secondly, I would also add that tech surveillance is also something that we need to be thinking about. And I think that's one of the lessons coming out of the South Korea model. Is that South Korea has used their legal infrastructure, which includes a serious surveillance and tracking of individuals using mobile phone geolocation, CCTV, credit card information that they can collect to try to find these people who might be infected or who are infected, so that they can spread the net to find other potential infections. These technologies can be harnessed for bad, for evil. But in this case, it's been harnessed. All of this information that's collected disappears or is removed after 4 weeks. And South Korea also has a very strong infrastructure privacy laws to protect individual privacy. And these are some of the things, the legal framework, I think, in terms of using surveillance technologies is something that is also a lesson that comes out of this, is that there has to be some sort of mechanism that we use technology to combat coronavirus. So let me stop there.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we've now got questions from the audience and from other participants. And so I'd like to condense a couple of those and begin with a question or a subject that David Dollar alluded to himself earlier, but several of the members of the audience have as well, which is to look at Africa specifically, but developing countries in general, to take stock of what we might know of how the virus is now affecting those countries. It's a lot of countries, it's a lot of regions, so I don't expect everybody to have information on each, but maybe we'll start with David, since he brought it up earlier, and ask first, how is the virus now moving through the developing world? We know it's quite bad in Brazil and getting worse in India, so there's at least a couple of places where it's a problem, but Beyond that immediate question is the broader subject of how the world should be trying to help developing nations in particular. And again, David touched on some of the paths we might consider. So let me start with you and then ask anybody else who wishes to speak as well. I'm sure Tony will have things to say also. David.
So thank you, Mike. The data show that the virus is really accelerating around Latin America. There are quite a few Latin American countries that are high up in the tables with the number of infections per 100,000 people, number of deaths, et cetera. India, as you say, also has a spreading case. Probably some other Asian populist countries like Indonesia and Pakistan, but the data are not always clear. In Africa, it's interesting that the severity of the COVID-19 cases is not too great at the moment. It is accelerating. It's possible that weak testing is leading to these results at the moment. What we can be sure about in Africa is that there's a serious economic recession. Per capita GDP is going to go down 5% this year. It's projected to grow at zero next year. This is the poorest part of the world, and there's likely to be quite a bit of economic hardship. I would like to clarify that some African countries are in quite good shape in terms of their finances and their external debt. So I've mentioned the risk of debt crises. That'll be throughout the developing world, but I think it'll be have most human impact in a number of African countries. But, you know, we have to differentiate. It's great that the G20 came out quickly with this debt moratorium, but that's a very small first step because it just means countries do not have to pay interest in principal during 2020, but the interest continues to accrue. Now, the Chinese have already called for extending this, so that's quite positive. But some countries like Kenya have said they don't want a debt moratorium, because it's going to affect their credit rating and their access to private markets. So I think we have to differentiate that there will be some relatively well-managed countries that can get through this, and then there will probably be other countries that need some serious financial help and debt relief. Lots of countries are turning to the IMF for IMF programs to deal with their collapse in exports and their need to service their debt. So I think that's really one of the important priorities for the world, just because the virus is spreading in places where there's a lot of poverty already. And so that seems to me a priority for the world, trying to help with that.
Let me go to Tony next. And I'm also curious about the specific issue of the vaccine. Once we have one, how are we going to ensure that manufacturing is robust and transnational and rapid, and then distribution is rapid as well? I don't know if, Tony, that's something you thought about, but if not, maybe I'll come back to David on that. Let me also assure the audience that if you're tuning in now, this is not a Star Trek episode where I've somehow frozen Jung Pak with some kind of a advanced weapon like in one of the Star Trek episodes. Luckily, her voice, Jung, your voice came through pretty well in your last answer, but at some point your image froze and it remains that way. But it's a good image, and hopefully you're still able to hear us and maybe participate a little later on. But let me now go to Tony on the broader question of Africa and the developing world.
Yeah, thanks. And I would agree with David that in terms of Africa, one of the question marks is the level of testing and whether we're actually really know or have good data as to the severity of the spread and transmission. One of the things I'll also note is that in Africa, as well as other places of Latin America, what cities are concerned about, and actually this is a place where, you know, best practices and exchange of what's happened, because a lot of the initial transmission happened in countries that were at particular, you know, higher levels of development, had higher levels of infrastructure, health infrastructure, and other means. And now you've got cities trying to think about how do we mitigate and serve people that are living in informal settlements that are very densely packed together, as well as a big part of the informal economy. So how are they going to be economically affected? That might not even show up in the data very well. I mean, we have some places, for example, in Africa, where 80% of the economy is an informal economy and not really captured very well in formal data. And so local leaders are trying to have to make decisions that adapt practices and be able to meet the needs of what's actually going to be happening in their communities. And you have a real wide range. You have people trying to severely lock down and really enforce a severe lockdown to mitigate. And then you have others that are actually trying to be more community-minded and just sort of integrate into the community everything from hand-washing stations and sort of pop-up health clinics to try to do what they can as transmission spreads. On the question of a vaccine, I think, you know, what's important is that we do have some infrastructure in the international community, Gavi, the Vaccines Alliance, the WHO, the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, Malaria. I mean, you know, institutions that the public health community and countries are used to working through. And Celia mentioned the pledging that was happening with Gavi to be able to develop vaccine. There are established sort of global health networks and protocols to enable and deliver medicines and vaccines when they occur. I think the big question, and I agree with David on this, is will major powers and major countries like the United States and China cooperate on that? And there's also a lot of money at play. And so how do you ensure that it becomes accessible to those of lesser means? I think it's still a big question mark, one in which the international community is concerned about working hard on, but one in which there's still a lot of uncertainty.
Thank you. I don't know if Suzanne, Celia, or Jung wants to speak to that question as well. Otherwise, I'll move on to another question.
I'll just jump in real quickly and just reinforce the point on testing that, you know, you really have a situation of dramatic differentials in inequality across the Middle East. And so in countries like the United Arab Emirates, something of north of 20% of the population has already been tested. In countries like Egypt, which, you know, has significant deficits in terms of basic sanitation and public health conditions, you have less than 0.1% of the population that's been tested. And so I think we're still trying to assess the spread of the pandemic in countries where there is simply a lower capacity to track and monitor as well as treat the disease. And that means that, as several of my prior panelists have said, that, you know, this isn't over until it's really over. And I think, you know, particularly as travel expands across the region and across the world, when countries reopen, we're going to see multiple waves of this crisis hit both rich and poor countries.
Thank you. Let me pick up on the travel question, because that segues into another query we've received from the audience and participants on the webinar to ask about what people would anticipate by way of travel. It's sort of an unfair question in the sense that it's very broad. It's obviously going to depend greatly on countries, regions. I think U.S. air travel is now about one-fifth or one-sixth of what it was before the crisis, but several times greater than it had been in the early spring. So let me ask about generalizing that question to international travel. And at what point do you anticipate that we will see significant movement again? You know, maybe not quite at the level as before, but, you know, let's say maybe half the level of before. Is that going to have to await a vaccine, or are we likely to see a resumption much sooner than that, now that some best practices are emerging about how to stay safe, even in public transit? I don't know if anybody wants to try that question. Celia.
I can just let you know a little bit of what's been decided in Europe. You know that European EU member states decided to restrict non-essential travel within the European Union, which was unprecedented, and it was feared to be a decision that would change the nature of the EU, where freedom of movement is at the heart of its identity. So initially for a period of 30 days, and then it has been pushed over again and again. Now, since June 15, these restrictions are lifted due to the lowering of infections all across the board, even though in the specific case of France, people traveling from Spain and from the UK, for example, are still invited to quarantine upon arrival. They're just invited, and so it's not going to be enforced. It's just a measure of prevention. Beginning on July 1st, travelers from third countries will be, meaning the US, but others as well, will be evaluated and see if they are invited to travel back to Europe, in which case maybe, you know, countries that have had this stellar management of the crisis, such as South Korea or New Zealand, will probably be obvious candidates for traveling freely, and I'm not sure about the US. We're all dreaming of going back to Greece for the summer holidays, and I would dream of that. So, but it's probably not going to happen for Americans for a while, given that the infections are getting back up now. In general, what we've seen is a willingness to just stay in your country for the summer. There's an encouragement to spend the summer holidays in your own country. There's been, even if freedom of movement is back, there's been much less travel all across the board, just essential travel, and people who've been separated for months now are starting to be reunited, which is nice. The big question will be on students, but, you know, the Erasmus program has been partially cancelled. And the big question will be on reopening of universities. A lot of universities have decided to go online for September, so they might not invite students back, but the question of international students will be a big one. So as to reopen and have a full, you know, back to before type of travel, It's just impossible to imagine at this point until we have a serious treatment and serious vaccine, but more than that, a vaccine and or treatment that have universal access. Because once again, if there is national priority because of a national champion that develops a vaccine towards a country or region, this will really impede the opportunity to travel back as before. And I think that should be the priority, is universal access.
Thank you. I want to ask a question of Zheng, which I think naturally goes to her. And then I'm going to have one broad question for everyone to finish the webinar, which is a combination of a number of the queries we've received from participants. So Zheng, I wondered, thank you for rejoining by phone. I wondered if you wanted to comment on the travel question in regard to Northeast Asia, where a number of countries have been pretty successful in tamping down the spread of the virus. Is that allowing for a resumption of international travel with Korea, China, Japan, et cetera? And then secondly, we've had a number of questions from the audience about school. And both Celia and Zheng mentioned that there are some places where school is resuming, South Korea and France being two. And I think there are a lot of American parents who are very curious about the likelihood that their kids will be able to go to school in the fall and hopefully not have to be brought back home during a second wave. I realize it's pretty conjectural, but are there any lessons or at least initial working hypotheses you might want to suggest from what South Korea has already learned about sending its kids back to school? So, Zheng, over to you.
Hi, all. Sorry you have to look at a couple of blobs instead of my actual presence, but I'm here. So thanks for persevering. So on the travel, you know, South Korea, Japan, and China are in conversations about business travel. But from South Korea, you know, visitors coming from overseas are required to download an app that tracks their whereabouts. Health authorities keep tabs on their health. And they get text messages every day for 14 days with a reminder to input their health conditions. And for people who don't comply, they face fines or immediate deportation if they violate self-isolation. So, you know, you have to, foreign travelers have to be abiding by these restrictions and guidelines in South Korea. And this is something that that has been in place at South Korea for the past several months. So on the schools question, the schools have, the way that South Korea, as far as I understand it, has been working out is that they're trying to implement or they have implemented social distancing. In some of these pictures, you can see where the schools have put up barriers, these clear, you know, plexiglass barriers in between students so that to enforce the distancing. And these are disinfected multiple times a day to make sure that there aren't infections that, you know, that get out of control. You know, that said, you know, the tests are free and widely available. And so there's that element of that supports this this network of South Korea's counter coronavirus infrastructure.
Are the kids back pretty much in normal numbers and normal hours, or are they staggering and doing half days, things like that?
I think they're staggering at this point. And as I mentioned before, the South Korean authorities have fully bought into that, you know, there might have to be changes as they go. So I think it's that flexibility that I think is important, and assessing and monitoring as they slowly start to reopen, stagger schools and reduce work hours or have flexible work hours.
And before I go to Tony for a quick comment on international travel, Celia, is that similar to France, or is France all in?
It's supposed to be all in on June 22nd when all schools will reopen up to middle school and on a compulsory basis. So you will have to send your kids to school. But the reality, what I heard from local officials is that many schools are not prepared. They're just not big enough because you're supposed to double down with social distance as well. So there might be adaptation, the theory being that all kids should be back to school.
Thank you. Tony, over to you for a comment on travel, whether it's within Europe or wherever else you're most focused.
Actually, I wasn't just going to, so I'm not going to prognosticate, and I agree with a lot of what Celia said, but I was just going to, you know, suggest to our viewers that a bellwether to keep in mind is, you know, these global international meetings where decision makers come together, are they being held in person or not? UN General Assembly, not going to happen in person this year in September. The global climate change negotiations that were meant to happen in the fall, delayed. Let's see what happens in Davos. Are people actually going to come together in Davos? Planning for that to happen now, but I think there you start to get the temperature, so to speak, literally and metaphorically, of where the leadership of the global community is. And get a sense of how comfortable they feel. And I think that's a bit of a bellwether for how much international travel come back as well.
Thank you. So one last question for everyone, and I'm going to ask for roughly a 1 to 2 minute response from each panelist in the same order that we began, so starting with David. But the question is this, and it really builds on a number of comments and questions we've had from participants for which we're grateful. Sort of how have the democracies done so far as democracies, as forms of government in addressing COVID? On balance, has this been an experience that has revealed weakness in democracies, their commitment to protection of human life, their ability to organize? David touched on this earlier, so maybe I can already guess where he's going to go. But because the questions did come in along these lines, I'm going to rephrase and bring them together and ask each of you to talk about sort of at the high level of geopolitics and competition, China versus the United States, democracies versus non-liberal societies or autocracies. Are we seeing any kind of an initial verdict on which systems of government have done better and which are more suited to handle this kind of a problem? David, to you, please, and then we'll go to Suzanne, Tony, Celia, and John Pack to finish up.
So as we discuss different cases around the world, it strikes me that most of the success stories are democracies. So I think democracy comes out of this looking pretty good. I agree with a point that Tony made that, you know, a lot of this has to do with local government. And in many countries, people feel closer to their local government than the central officials. The U.S. story is complicated. You know, the whole national story is pretty disastrous, but there are some good local examples around the country. But other than the United States, I think democracies have come out of this looking pretty well. You know, China is a very complicated, special case. You know, I lived there for a long time. You know, people really do value social order. I think this traces back to the terrible experience of the Cultural Revolution, even though that's several decades back now. So it was relatively easy to get Chinese people to voluntarily comply with a lot of these pretty tight restrictions. And that's what I'm hearing from some of the other success stories, is where communities voluntarily take up the advice of the scientific experts, the health experts, things have worked out pretty well. And where, you know, people have ignored the advice of the scientific experts, things have been pretty disastrous.
Thank you. Suzanne.
Well, I wanted to take the opportunity to refer people, viewers and others, to the volume that we published itself, because we've got a terrific piece by my colleague Shadi Hamid, effectively examining the question of the extent to which reopening has benefited authoritarians, and whether this question of kind of performance legitimacy, as the political science describe it, has actually worked to the benefit of authoritarians. He's got a really interesting take on that. Of course, with respect to the Middle East, it's hard to talk about democracy. The one true democracy in the Middle East, Israel, has, in fact, I think, performed quite well in terms of managing the crisis and then reopening. There are others, including my colleagues Natan Sachs and Kevin Huggers, who wrote about the Israeli case for our volume, which is on the Brookings website, who can speak to what it meant for Israeli democracy itself, and I'll leave that to experts. But I think that what we see is, you know, effectively where there are low levels of trust in government, which, of course, does correspond to those countries where there is less accountability, where there is where the governments themselves are less representative. The handling of the crisis and the process of reopening has been messier and more costly in terms of human lives and economic impact. That's certainly true in Iran. Iranians, in many cases, ignored the initial invocations of the government to stay in their homes and to avoid traveling during the New Year's holiday because they were so frustrated and effectively don't trust anything that comes out of their senior officials, particularly when they were openly contradicting one another. And at the same time, we've seen something similar during the reopening. Iran has instituted a kind of multi-tier process for different provinces and cities, depending on the level of caseload and hospitalization. And so there are places where business as usual returned as early May, including a return to schools in some cases. But many parents were disinclined to send their kids back to school simply because they don't believe what they're hearing from government officials. And of course, some of that has been borne out by the second wave in a number of parts of the country. So I think, you know, there's going to be a variety of takeaways, but I do think it's important to push back on the kind of simplistic assumptions that prevailed at the early phase of the crisis that, you know, authoritarian states might, in fact, do better in managing this crisis.
Thank you very much. Tony.
I think what I would say, and I would agree with David, that on whole, you know, we've seen a good response, a slightly better response from democracies. But I would say at the local level as well, that what this crisis has done is activated the democratic impulse. There is a lot of civic participation, both at the citizen level, as well as leaders of business, philanthropy, universities. You're seeing cities bring together, like in Bristol, UK, a governance board to help think about what the future looks like. And to Jung Pak's point, it's not over till it's over. For local leaders, it's not just about COVID and about the public health dimensions of this, but it's not over until their economies are back to a point where people are whole again. And they want to reshape those economies. And what they're hearing from their citizens is to reshape those economies in a new way, one that has equity at the center, to Celia's point, one that is climate sensitive and greener, and one that, you know, has a more holistic view and is much more equal. And that's what their citizens are expecting. And I think that's what you're going to see from the democracies and those cities, and to be able to take advantage both of the political momentum, but to meet the democratic crying out that they're hearing from their.
Excellent. Thank you. Celia.
Well, as I said earlier, I think one of the elements that were most striking is that in spite of difficulty, especially difficulty on the onset of the crisis when the lockdown was imposed at a moment where, you know, the society became really scared, but no one really knew what to do. And so the first types of decisions and lack of transparency over testing, over masks were heavily criticized. But overall, in France, as in many other European countries, I think what you see is that a strong trust in the institutions of your own democracy, really bodes well for the future, including for reopening, because people followed lockdown orders and now are following carefully, gradually, the reopening orders without any protesting. I think it's a good element also to have strong belief and trust in the science and expertise. There was no questioning of science and expertise as the type that we see here. I believe yesterday Dr. Fauci was talking about an anti-science bias in the US, which is regrettable. And I don't think it's helping with the sort of logical decisions that have to be taken when faced with a pandemic. So overall, I think democracies, European democracies at least, have proven to be holding up. The first months of reaction were some nationalistic, some panicky, some of it with a little bit of a messy response. But overall, on the course of this crisis, it's back to having solid societies, solid institutions, and now a much better European Union cooperation.
Fantastic. And Jung Pak for the last word.
Hi, thank you. So I think I agree with Suzanne, especially on, you know, we shouldn't put this authoritarian versus democracy, but I think South Korea has done a really good job of showing what a democracy can do. And as others have mentioned, it's about governance and trust and transparency in the government. And what we saw back in April 15th with the national legislative elections in South Korea, even as some of the big countries, including Britain, postponed their elections, and almost 20 states in the United States canceled or postponed their own elections, that South Korea went ahead even during the pandemic with guidelines on how to elect and exercise your citizenship in that way, but safely. In that election, 66% of eligible voters in South Korea showed up to vote. This was the highest level that they had seen in decades. And I think that was a really strong symbol and signal of the people's trust in the government that the government had provided a way for citizens to exercise democracy. And I'm really heartened by what Tony Pippa has said about at this moment activating democratic participation. And I love that I'm leaving this panel with that in my mind.
Well, very well said. And my only final word, in addition to thanking everyone on the panel and everyone on the Brookings team and everybody outside of Brookings who's been part of this, is that I come away from this more encouraged than I expected. There are a lot of good practices developing and being implemented, and they're happening at the level of the nation state, at the level of cities. There's collaboration across countries in Europe. There's collaboration with cities and mayors working together around the whole world. People are learning from each other. There are the big unanswered questions about how we're going to do multilaterally at the formal nation state level and with multilateral organizations when we get to the big questions about vaccine distribution and manufacture, as well as economic recovery. And I think on that big question, we have, as I think everybody would agree on this panel, a very uncertain verdict. And it's way too soon to tell or know. And I hope that some national governments, maybe starting with my own, get a little more focused on these questions than we've been so far. So if I'll finish with that small little sermonette, and also my thanks and gratitude to everyone. Best wishes. Have a great weekend and good luck with the next stage of the recovery. And as John Allen said at the beginning, please stay safe and healthy.